I am so excited. I'm not even lying about it. This new iPhone app for CCV, have you noticed it? Have you seen it? Have you downloaded it? You can figure out what neighborhood group is closest to you by the GPS on the phone. Love that. You can hear a podcast, the sermons. Love that. You can keep up with all the latest news and happenings. But my favorite thing about the new iPhone app, it's really going to help me. You know how Pastor Don is really good at like filling in all the blanks that are on the program? It's just not part of my gift mix. So I apologize to all of you people who are like a type A's. You catch me after service and you go, you left out a blank. It's like St. Peter's going to ask you for that question to get into heaven and you won't know the answer. So for the security of all your salvations, go buy an iPhone 5. Download the CCV app. You'll be good to go for eternity. I'm excited about that. A couple years ago, I was in Manhattan, Kansas, and there was a young college student there, and I was just trying to get to know her a little bit. So I said, hey, do you have any like weird phobias that you want to tell me about so that I could laugh at you? And she goes, yeah, actually, I do. Her phobia, she had a terrible fear of cotton balls. No, seriously, I don't know what to make of that. So I looked it up. There's actually a name for it. It's called sit-on globophobia. And like a lot of people apparently have this, you know, that cotton balls frighten them. Here's another one. Coulrophobia. You know what it is? Fear of clowns. Some people are really terrified, and I can't blame them. Little children with these guys with big feet and red noses. I mean, why you would take your kids to that, I do not know. Here's another one. Ketophobia. Ketophobia is the fear of hair. You're welcome. I'm just trying to make everybody comfortable here. Here's my favorite. Omphalophobia. Omphalophobia is the fear of belly buttons. I want to meet someone because I can't figure that one out. What is it about the belly button that is so terrifying that you have this phobia of it? So I really do want to meet someone with omphalophobia. So I thought about coming out here in a tube top and see who scatters. But then I thought maybe everyone would scatter, and so that's not going to work. Oledoxophobia. Oledoxophobia is the fear of opinions. And you know what I think about that? Tophophobia. Tophophobia is the fear of being buried alive. And I don't know why they call it a phobia. I think we should all have that. Right? It's not like an unreasonable fear. Phobias are unreasonable fears. But I think all of us have like reasonable fears. I know Joshua did. This week you'll be reading in the story, chapter 6 and chapter 7. It's one of those like man texts of wars and swords, and it's just a great text to read. A lot of good stories. But Joshua stands on the precipice of the promised land looking in at giants. Like right across the river was Jericho. High walls mean people. He had plenty to be afraid of. And I think that's relevant because I was talking to our staff this week, getting ready for the message, about what we're really facing as a congregation. There are some of you that right now, you've got a teenage kid or early 20s that child is making decisions that they will have to pay for decades in the future, and you have no way to reel them in. You've warned them till you're blue in the face, but nothing is changing it. Some of you are afraid for jobs, particularly you men. A lot of men in our congregation have been out of work for 2 or 3 years, stringing together part-time labor, 2 and 3 jobs at a time, just to put food on the table. These are trying times. We have fears when we go to the doctor. Some people have the fear because the doctor says, I don't know what you have. Others of us have the fear because the doctor says, I do know what you have, and there's nothing we know that will fix it. We have marriages where you're at this place where your marriage is, you see it, you feel it slipping through your fingers, and you're trying to grab a hold of the threads of your marriage, and nothing is working, and you don't know how you got to this place, and you sure don't know how you're going to get out of it. Our housing market is still a mess. So many people in Phoenix are upside down on their mortgage. You know that in the first half of this year, according to the Realty Track, the organization that tracks this, there were 1,045,000 foreclosures in the first half of 2012. That, added together with the other foreclosures, tops us out over 3 million for this crisis. The scariest news is we're not even halfway through the foreclosures. And of all the states that are suffering with this, Arizona is number 2 on the list. There are some 50,000 homes right here in Maricopa County that are in danger. And if you are African American, it's even worse. If you're Hispanic, the numbers are dismal. We are suffering, and we have these giants standing right in front of us. Are you ready to talk about Joshua? Because the lessons that he teaches us will help us manage our own fear and our own giants that we have to face. And I guess that all of our fears could be put under two banners: changes and challenges. That summarizes most of it for us. The change is, it's not a really terrible fear, but it is stressful. And the Israelites, when they moved from the desert into the promised land, were changing geographies from a desert to the mountains. I've gone backwards. I've gone to the mountains of Missouri, here to the desert. I get change. And it's been a great change, don't get me wrong, but all change is stressful change. And many of you, transient like me, have just come in and you're trying to figure out, where do you shop? Where do you take your car to the Department of Motor Vehicles? All of these questions just add stress to your life, and you're living it just like I am, you know. But geography usually means a change in vocation. It did for me. And even though I've preached a lot, the staff of this church, they've been wonderful with me, but I still have this steep learning curve how to fit into the CCV environment and do things in ways that make sense here. Again, wonderful change. But like you, if you've taken on a new job, or if you've gone to a new college trying to figure out your way around campus, or if you've got a new family member that's come in, you're a new parent trying to figure out, okay, which end do I put the diaper on, things like that. This is, you know, a difficult time in your life. But the most difficult of all is a change of leadership. We're going from Moses to Joshua. Moses is now 120 years old. Joshua is a young buck, but listen to what he says in the story on page 83. As Moses is trying to help out with this transition, the Lord said to Moses, bottom of the page, next to the last paragraph. The Lord said to Moses, take Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom is the spirit of leadership, and lay your hand on him. Have him stand before Eleazar the priest and the entire assembly and commission him in their presence. Give him some of your authority, so the whole Israelite community will obey him. Anytime we have a change in leadership, it always kind of throws our world upside down a little bit. So if you are, you have a new supervisor, you have a new professor, you've changed jobs, maybe you're newly married or newly widowed, the leadership structure of your life changes, and you're trying to figure out just where you fit. That's where Joshua was. And it's not just the giants that lay before him. It's the challenges of moving from the desert to the promised land. The change is going to be difficult for him. But the battle, that's where the real fear is. This is the, under challenges, point number one. He had a battle to face. And the first one, it was a big one. Like Jericho, a little tidbit here, it is the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. Is today, was then. That gives them time to build really thick walls and to put up an army that is really well trained. Jericho was a challenge, and the Israelites on their own are not ready for it. They need a stellar battle plan. Problem: God's ways are not our ways. And God is going to use three things that I would never choose in a million years as his primary weapons. Number one, he chooses a woman, specifically a prostitute. The story goes like this. In page 90 and 91, this woman named Rahab lives in Jericho. And the spies from Israel go in to check out the vulnerabilities of the city. That was shrewd. And it was also shrewd to go to a prostitute's house because they could get in and out of her house without people asking, well, why is somebody going in and out of her house? Because, well, never mind. What is shocking is that Rahab saves them. I want you to listen on page 90 and 91. At the bottom of the page, last paragraph, before the spies lay down for the night, she went up on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given you this land and that a great fear of you has fallen on us so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We've heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is in heaven above and on earth below. You remember your mama telling you about that snake? It's more afraid of you than you are of it. That's hard to believe, isn't it? Here Israel is with an enemy across the river, and the enemy is more afraid of them than they are of the enemy. And don't you forget that. Sometimes we look at our enemies, whether it is someone who is antagonistic to the faith, or maybe this week has been a good reminder that we have lots and lots of enemies. On the 11th anniversary of 9/11, they just popped out of everywhere. They were angry and they were violent. You realize, of course, it's the same geography that Joshua is in. It's no different today than it was back then. And he is trying to go into a land of people who hate him and people have military resources to fight against him. It was a terrifying proposition. And God, as his primary ally, uses a prostitute. But what she revealed was telling. Gentlemen, we are more afraid of you than you are of us. We've heard about what your God did. Mark that. It wasn't the swords of Israel that terrified the Jericho people. It was the God of Israel. God doesn't need your power. He needs your attention. And isn't it sad when pagans have a higher view of God than Christians? We're afraid to go next door and share Christ with our neighbors. Why? Are you kidding me? It's not like they're the Antichrist. They're your neighbor. Why would you be afraid to tell them about Christ when you have the Holy Spirit in you and God behind you? You might be afraid to stand up at work. You might be afraid of leading your family in a spiritual pilgrimage to Christ. Why? The God of the universe stands at the ready to empower you to take the territory that he's put in front of you. Here's the second thing that God used. Let me stop before I get to the B. Rahab, interesting, isn't just written into the story of the Old Testament. She's written into the story of the New Testament. See, this is her lower story here in Jericho. She could never have imagined that her name would be so famous among Christians. Three times in the New Testament, she's mentioned. James chapter 2, she's put side by side with Abraham, the father of the nation, with a prostitute. You got to be kidding me. Listen, don't you ever underestimate, especially if you're a woman, don't you ever underestimate what God can do with the person of faith. It doesn't matter what the first chapter of your biography was. God can end the story in a very different way than it began. What you inherited does not necessarily mark your inheritance. And so here Rahab is in James 2. She's also in Hebrews 11. For those of you familiar with the Bible, that is it's just a list of very famous people from the Old Testament. It might be called the Hall of Fame of the Faith. And there you have, well, the kind of people that we studied in the first 4 weeks of the story. You've got an Abraham there, and you've got a Joseph there, and you've got a Joshua there, you've got a Moses there, and here is this woman who is living and earning her living as a prostitute, and she gets into the Hall of Fame of the faith? Yes, because she believed in the God of Israel. The most important passage she's mentioned in is Matthew 1, which is the genealogy of Jesus. See, it doesn't matter where you come from. It matters where God can take you. And he allowed her to become one of the foremothers of Jesus Christ himself. That's impressive. The second thing God used, B, is a scalpel. I never would have guessed this, and it certainly would not have been my military strategy. Page 92, just a snippet. I mean, one sentence summarizes the story. Very top of the page. Once camped on the other side, the circumcisions were performed. Okay. So we're going to go across and we're going to get into a hand-to-hand combat fight with trained soldiers, and we are shepherds from the desert. Great. So how are we going to train? I know. Let's all go have outpatient surgery that lays us up for a week. Great idea. The only able-bodied people in the camp are the women. But God doesn't need your able body. He needs your obedience. Lesson well learned. The third thing God used. Well, let me illustrate it here. All the dudes in the house are going, yeah, that's manly. Which would you choose? A sword or a trumpet? They call it a shofar, but it's a Jewish ancient trumpet. Which would you choose? A? B? Probably the sword. Not God. God says, I want you to arm the soldiers with trumpets. What is that? It's like, if you don't back down, I swear I will blow this at you. I am not even kidding now. I'll huff and I'll pluff and I'll blow your walls down. That's where that started. God said, I've got a military strategy for you, Joshua. I want you to get some trumpets like this, and I want you to walk around the city, day one. Just walk around. What do you want me to do? Just blow the horn. All right, what do I do the next day? Walk around the city. Yeah, and then what? Blow the horn. How long is this going to go on, God? Well, 6 days. 6 days? You just want me to blow a horn? Yeah, but only once each day. Okay, on the seventh day, what do I do? Do it seven times. Yeah, that'll scare them. I mean, by the end of the week, they're a laughingstock, and the Jerichos are going, yeah, they didn't send out the football team. They sent out the pep band. And then on day seven, and the walls come a-tumbling down. You know the story. It is a fantastic scene. The walls come down, and their faith rises. And they realize God is the God of Israel. And the battle is not in our hands. It's in his hands. And the victory goes to the Lord, not to me. And so they were ready under Joshua's leadership. Let's go. Let's go to the next town. What is it? And God said, well, there's a little burb up there. It's called Ai, spelled A-I. Go get him, tiger. So Joshua, he didn't even send the whole troops. He just sent 5,000 people up there, and they got whooped. Several dozen Israelite soldiers died. And Joshua comes back to God and says, God, what is up with that? I mean, we had this in a bag. How did we lose? And God said, because I told you at Jericho, don't take the gold, don't take the silver, don't take the garments, but you have a thief in your midst. I wanted you to destroy everything to set a point that God is not going to put up with paganism at all. But you had a guy who pilfered from Jericho, and he did. They cast lots and eventually found out that his name was Achan. He couldn't keep his grubby hands off the gold and the silver, and he put it in his tent, hid it underneath where he was sleeping, and they found him out, and once they punished him, they could move on in their march. You see, God doesn't need our power. He needs our obedience. And perhaps you, like Joshua, is standing at the precipice of the promised land, and you're facing some giants, and you're asking a question, but I know what I fear. I mean, it's keeping me up at night. How do I overcome it? The story will give us two suggestions. Suggestion number one is look back at God's provision. People who don't have a good hindsight really don't move forward in God's timing and in His ways. Page 85 and 86 of the story twice mentions the same thing. God says to the Israelites, you know that for 40 years in the wilderness, I provided for you. Your sandals never wore out. Your clothes never tore. You were fed from manna from the sky. You got water from a rock that gushed out in a desert. Was I not faithful to you? Takeaway number one, for those of you experiencing fear, is remember the faithfulness of God. If you cannot do that, you cannot move forward. So I want you to do something right now. Think about a time, a specific time when you were terribly afraid. It might be when you were a child and your parents were separated. Or a teen when you got in an accident. Or maybe in your 20s when some relationship broke apart. Maybe in your 30s or 40s. Maybe right now as you lost a job. When in your life have you been most terrified? Question. How'd God do? Was He unfaithful to you? Did He turn His back on you? I'm not asking if He took the pain away or if He took the challenge away. He typically leaves it there so that you can be victorious. But was He faithful to you? If the answer is yes, and it always is, if God was faithful to you in your past, why would you doubt Him with your future? So we move to step number two, look forward to God's promise. God made a promise to Joshua. In fact, I want to read it to you and ask that you underline it in the story. It's on page 89. It's the fifth line down. It begins, I will give you every place where you set your foot as I promised. Every place you set your foot, I will give you. So you want Jericho? Then step out in faith. I will give you Jericho. You want Jerusalem? Step out in faith. I will give you Jerusalem. Samaria? Step out in faith. I'm not going to just give it to you because I ask. You got to step out in faith. And the hardest step they ever took was at the edge of the Jordan River. The Bible says it was at flood stage. And the priests of God were carrying the Ark of the Covenant. And as they stepped into the water, it stopped at that instant, not before. As they stepped into the water stopped. And if you read the Bible carefully, you will realize the place where it stopped flowing was 20 miles upstream. God made a way for Israel. Before they ever stepped in, God knew the moment they would, and God has already provided for you a way through this difficulty if you will have faith in Him to take that first step. God will take it from there. And so the takeaway for you is, claim some real estate. I mean, like choose a place where you're going to put your foot and say, God, if you're really behind me, I'll take this spot. The book of Romans quotes from the story, page 86 and 87. In the Bible, it's Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 12 and 13. And what Paul is saying in Romans is that what was imaged here, clear in the Old Testament, is really pointing towards Christ. That's the upper story. It goes like this. You can read it in your program. Do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven, that is, to bring Christ down, or who will descend into the deep, that is, to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is, the word of faith we're proclaiming, that if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised Him from the dead, you will be saved. Now look, I know that we're not Israel. And this valley that we're in is not the promised land. But if God wanted Israel to fill the promised land, don't you think He wants His new Israel, the church, that is the people who by faith have been adopted into the family of Abraham? We are Israel. Don't you think He wants us to fill this valley? And where you put your foot, do you not believe that the God of Joshua will be behind you and the Christ of faith will be around you. He can save you as you take a step of faith for him. I want to read one more verse from the story. It's on page 101. It's at the end of this tale of Joshua entering into the promised land, and they've conquered some territory, and they're ready to live in the land. But Joshua realizes that the people of Israel often look back to other gods, back to Egypt, and the gods they used to serve, the gods of the Amorites, the Canaanites. And Joshua looks them in the eye and says, you have to make a decision today. Who are you going to serve? Are you going to serve the gods all around us, or will you serve the one true living God? That God who parted water, who can walk on water, will you serve that God? That God who feeds you from heaven and feeds you from the very body of his son, will you serve that God? That God who brought them into Canaan and conquered their enemies without even raising a sword, the walls just came down. That same God who saves you and brings you into his family, will you serve that God? There's one verse here I want you to underline. It is at the bottom of the page, five lines up. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. And I don't know what that means for you, but I do know it will mean you taking a step and watching what God can do with a step that you take. So my question is, where are you going to put your foot? If God promised, wherever you put your foot, I'll honor that, and I will be behind you. Christ will be around you. Where will you put your foot? Man, you may not be able to take your whole neighborhood. You may not be able to have that whole geography for Christ, but I bet you could take your kitchen table and say, at this table, this will be where God does his business. And I may not be able to save my whole neighborhood, but by God's strength, I will bring my family to Christ. I will love my wife as Christ loved the church, and I will raise my children in the faith. Will you claim your table for Christ? For some of you, you need to claim not the kitchen table, but the coffee table, not in your home, but at Starbucks, where you meet with friends and you do your homework and you talk about the day's news. Will you claim that Starbucks for Christ where you meet? Perhaps if you're a teenager, you need to claim some URLs for Christ in the back of your bedroom, in the history of your computer, and say, this will be a place where God is honored. Maybe you need to claim your next door neighbor's house and just say, with God's help, I want to share the love of Christ. See, we still fight battles with a trumpet. We don't have to pick up a sword. It's not with bloodshed. It is the proclamation of the living God. And when we go to our neighbors or to our boss's office, to our ex, to our children, to our stepchildren, and we tell the story of Christ, giants are still falling in the land. God, we have 20,000 pairs of feet here. And I'm praying that every one of them would put something in the program, a place, a person, some geography of the heart, some geography of the mind, a place that they will claim with you behind us and Christ surrounding us. We claim territory for Christ in his name and by his power. Amen.